And without much further delays, we can get into our opening talk here, which is, again, to set the stage for the day, a journey through time, 50 years of the Safe Drinking Water Act. How has it evolved and grown over these last 50 years? Some of the major milestones. And we have a great speaker to help us present it, or at least we had. There he is. I was thinking Randy had maybe left the house, but he's still here. So Randy Ellingbo, who was for 10 years the director of the drinking water program at the State Department of Health. In that position, he served as the State Drinking Water Administrator. He was also the president of the National Association of State Drinking Water Administrators. So I can think of no better person to walk us through 50 years of the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Thank you, Sandeep, and thank you all for being here. It's a real pleasure to be here this morning and to have a chance to reflect on the Safe Drinking Water Act. As Sandeep said, celebrating a 50-year anniversary this coming year, Congress passed the Safe Drinking Water Act in 1974. And in the next few minutes here, my intent is to give you a little background on how it all started, some of the elements of the Safe Drinking Water Act, give you a little snapshot of how things have changed, and then touch briefly on what's been happening lately. So this drinking water, of course, has been an issue forever, the quality of drinking water. And here in this country, as far back as 1925, the U.S. Public Health Service had developed guidelines for drinking water quality, setting a number of guidelines for parameters like coliform and some inorganic chemicals and so on because of concerns over potential for drinking water to cause public health problems. And here in the Twin Cities, actually, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, they were leaders nationally in developing drinking water treatment programs. It was unfortunate that that came about because of some outbreaks of typhus in the early 20th century that drove the cities to develop drinking water programs to help protect public health. The U.S. Public Health Service revised those guidelines they originally developed in the 1940s, but then in the 1960s, there was growing awareness in the United States here of environmental concerns, and with those, public health concerns. The quality of the water across the country had come to the public's attention as being a potential problem environmentally as well as in terms of their health. And people like Rachel Carson brought additional attention to the public by books like Silent Spring, which talked about and brought to attention some of these environmental problems. And so public awareness was growing. In 1962, the U.S. Public Health Service set some additional goals or standards for drinking water in order, again, to protect public health. In 1963, Congress took on the issue of environmental problems by passing the First Clean Air Act. And, you know, what happens when the public takes interest is sometimes, thankfully, Congress takes action in order to help address some issues. And throughout the 1960s, that awareness was growing. The Environmental Protection Agency was created in 1970 in order to help address these growing concerns. Again, you know, it wasn't just books that brought this to our attention. Media reports and actually seeing things in the environment like the Cuyahoga River fire that happened in the just outside of Cleveland really brought some attention to these issues. And it wasn't the first river fire in our country, but it really began to focus the attention of the public on these issues. Moving along, moving towards the 1970s, when, again, Congress began to take further action on this. It was a banner year in a number of respects. those of you who are around then, I think there's some in the crowd who also remember this. The Watergate scandal ultimately led to President Nixon resigning. That was in 1974. Vice President Gerald Ford became president in August. There was an oil crisis in those days. It wasn't just environmental issues that the public was concerned about, but gas shortages led to lines around the block as people waited to be able to get gas. Inflation was at 11% or more. And then again, at the end of the year, Congress passed the Safe Drinking Water Act. President Ford signed the Safe Drinking Water Act in December. This information from a press release from James Agee, who was assistant administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, mentions that concern that the public had brought. Well, long and short of it was that. I'm sorry. Thanks for that tip. Again, the President Ford signed the Safe Drinking Water Act in December of 1974. In the wake of these headlines, the problems the public had seen and that Congress had taken action on, and the concerns about drinking water quality across the nation, it had been found that there were cancer-causing chemicals in New Orleans and Pittsburgh's drinking water, in Boston. They had a problem with lead in the water supply there. There had been viral and bacterial outbreaks across the country from contamination of drinking water, and all of these again led to the Safe Drinking Water Act being passed by Congress. I want to just draw your attention for a moment to the Clean Water Act as well. Congress didn't take action only on drinking water issues. They also passed the Clean Water Act in 1972. And these acts, while they complement each other, they are somewhat different. The Clean Water Act, again, focuses on water quality issues in the environment, in river, stream, and lake quality, and it set the first regulations for how to regulate discharges into these surface waters. Again, the Safe Drinking Water Act focuses on the quality of drinking water, and the early act set 22 standards for contaminants in drinking water. With the passage of the Act of Coal, of course, Congress's goal was to be able to have systems provide safe drinking water all across the U.S. by setting a set of uniform standards. The initial regulations codified the U.S. Public Health Service guidelines, setting 22 standards in the original regulations for a variety of contaminants that I'll talk about in just a minute. EPA was given the authority to develop rules around drinking water, and they were set a process to establish those rules. They were also given the authority to delegate the program to states, and so here in Minnesota and in 48 other states as well. Is this better? States can administer the rules. And so here in Minnesota, the state has what's called primacy to administer these drinking water standards, rules, and regulations. The requirement is that states must have regulations that are at least as strict as the federal regulations. The facilities that these rules pertain to fall into a couple different categories, community and non-community systems. For community public water supplies, those are defined as systems that have 15 or more connections to homes, buildings, and so on that provide water to these facilities year-round. also for facilities that may provide water to 25 or more people, 60 or more days per year, those are also subject to the regulations. So the first are called community public water systems. Those are municipal systems, the large water supply systems across the state that supply 15 or more connections. And then the non-community systems are those at schools, restaurants, and so on that are not connected to the larger community public water supplies but still supply water to the public. We've got 964 community public water supply systems here in Minnesota. We've got over 5,000 non-community public water supply systems, and all of those, again, are subject to these Safe Drinking Water Act requirements. The national primary drinking water regulations are legally enforceable primary standards and treatment techniques for these public water systems. And the goal here is by controlling or limiting the level of contaminants, again, the intent is to protect public health and prevent both disease outbreaks as well as the impacts from drinking these potential public health problem contaminants. And the categories include microorganisms, disinfectants, the byproducts from disinfecting drinking water, inorganic, organic chemicals, and radionuclides. Well, in the goals of setting these standards for public drinking water certainly are noble in terms of not only protecting public health, but in helping systems be able to operate their systems in a way that protects the public who's drinking the water. But developing these regulations with the system that EPA was given is rather complicated, and EPA had difficulty in moving regulations forward to address contaminants that were not in the original guidelines. And Congress ultimately got frustrated with EPA over the slow progress. And in 1986, they passed a number of amendments in the reauthorization of the Safe Drinking Water Act that set some new requirements for EPA. They required EPA to regulate an additional 83 contaminants over the next 5 years, with the goal of trying to get at least 25 new regulations every 5 years. EPA had trouble meeting those guidelines, or deadlines, I should say. They repeatedly missed the deadlines. They'd set new ones, and then the cycle would repeat. Unfortunately, because of that, EPA was unable to meet Congress's goal, and Congress again took action in 1996. They viewed what EPA had as a regulatory treadmill. It was just too difficult to get these standards through the regulatory process. And so Congress itself took some action, but it took multiple sessions of Congress in order to address some of the concerns over these changes needed to the Safe Drinking Water Act. They set some additional deadlines for EPA to create new rules and regulations on things like microbes and disinfectant byproducts, arsenic, and so on. They provided a new standard setting process for contaminants and required EPA to review the existing regulations every 6 years. Also out of the amendments, though, they made a significant change in order to help systems public water supply systems address some of the issues that they have to deal with in providing safe drinking water, and they created the Drinking Water State Revolving Loan Fund to provide financial assistance for public water supplies. They also created the requirement for public water supply systems to inform their customers of the quality of their water annually by publishing a consumer confidence report. And they also required systems to, if they were going to get drinking water revolving loans in order to help construct new infrastructure for their drinking water systems, they required those systems to have a capacity development program looking at the financial, technical, and management aspects of their systems to ensure that they were on track to be able to run well into the future. They required operator certification for those public water supply systems, and they also created the requirement to develop source water protection programs. All of those changes have been significant. They have led to the programs that we see now, but after 1996, Congress still took an interest in the Safe Drinking Water Act, and I won't go through each of these amendments that came about during the following years after 1996, but again, Congress continues to hold drinking water in its attention, and as an illustration, you may recall that in 2022, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act was passed in order to help provide funds to repair and replace, among other things, drinking water system infrastructure. And a significant amount of money was made available in order to help address problems in drinking water systems. I'd like to shift gears just a little bit now to talk not so much about Congress, but EPA's regulatory framework that they have to work under, which might help explain some of the difficulty that they have had in passing new regulations. One of the things that Congress required was that EPA develop a contaminant candidate list. There, of course, are many, many potential contaminants in the environment. It's difficult to know what's out there without doing a survey. And it's also difficult to know what might be a concern from a public health standpoint without doing some initial research and analysis of what might be potential problems. And so EPA is required to develop a contaminant candidate list, which is something of a starting place for regulation. It's to be able to take a look at what's out there and what might be a public health concern. And so periodically, there's a survey done nationally of what might be out there for contaminants in our public drinking water systems. And then ultimately, a determination may be made whether to regulate those contaminants found during the course of that nationwide survey. There are some requirements that if a regulatory determination is made, that timeline has to be met for developing those regulations. But again, that can be difficult at times to meet because EPA has to go through a cost-benefit analysis. And first of all, they need to consider whether or not the contaminant may have an adverse health effect. EPA needs to determine whether or not it's found widely enough across the country to merit developing a national regulation for it, and whether it's likely to cause significant public health effects. And ultimately, whether by removing the contaminants from drinking water, if they're found there, whether that's going to create a significant public health benefit. Out of this process, what are called maximum contaminant level goals are created, which would set, in essence, a limit for how much of that can be in drinking water and not create a public health problem. When that changes into a regulation, it's no longer a goal, it's a limit. And that's ultimately what public water supplies are required to meet. But as part of the process, there has to be a cost-benefit analysis, and that can be complicated, of course, in terms of answering the question whether removing this examination of how much of the contaminant is there, how widely spread is the contaminant, and will removing it at some substantial cost create a public health benefit, that is, protect those of us who drink the water. And because this is a public process, and EPA is required to take comments on this from citizens, from industry, from environmental groups, from state regulatory agencies, from public water supplies and associations, it can be quite a lengthy process. That said, EPA has made a number of changes, both after 1974 up until the 1996 amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act. Again, I won't go through the list here, but it's an illustration of some of those changes that EPA was able to make in terms of the drinking water regulations. And then after 1996 and some of the changes that Congress put towards EPA's process, they have made a number of changes to the regulations as listed on the right here. So, spent a lot of time talking about the regulatory aspect. Perhaps even more complicated than the regulatory aspect for public water supplies is how to deal with those contaminants that are not regulated. If a contaminant is regulated, meaning EPA and the states say a contaminant level can be no higher than such and such in your drinking water, the states and or EPA has the regulatory authority to, in essence, force those public water supplies to meet those limits, to build a treatment plant, for example, or find a new source that has lower levels of those contaminants and so protects public health by providing drinking water that has lower contaminant levels. But as we know here in Minnesota, there are unregulated contaminants like PFAS in our drinking water that also create public health concerns. Industry every year creates thousands, if not tens of thousands, of new chemicals. It's not always known what impacts those may have on our health if we ingest them through drinking water, for example. And again, the contaminant candidate list that EPA has to develop is intended to be able to identify some of those problems, but it doesn't set regulations for those. And so in the East Metro here, for example, where we have PFAS or polyfluorochemicals in our groundwater supplies and in our surface water supplies, the public water supplies who have those have to figure out whether or not to treat those and what to deal with them. And that is a challenge that I think we have wrestled with here for quite some time. And of course, public water supplies feel the responsibility of removing those compounds for their customers that cause a health concern. Moving to the current situation, again, we're wrestling with PFAS all across the country here, and EPA has set some guidelines for public water supplies to meet, but again, those are not regulatory numbers. The systems are choosing to treat their water to get levels below those guidelines. And so, for example, here in the East Metro, a number of the communities have installed granular activated carbon systems in order to deal with PFAS. problems there. EPA is developing a rule on that, expected to be out next year, but in the meantime, thankfully, places are taking action. Some of the other work EPA is doing right now on some other contaminant issues includes working on the lead and copper rule. We have lead service lines in many parts of the state here that are a concern. I'll talk in a moment about Flint, Michigan, but EPA is intending to update the lead and copper rule here shortly. And also, it's changing some of the requirements for consumer confidence reports because I think some of our ongoing press around drinking water issues across the country has led the public to ask for more information about their drinking water supplies. Quick tangent here into how public water supplies address concerns over contaminants in drinking water. The goal is to have a multi-barrier approach to treating drinking water and providing safe drinking water to the customers. First of all, it's required that the systems be monitored, and that's both doing regular water sampling and analysis, but it also includes site visits by our Minnesota Department of Health staff. And the second barrier to provide safe drinking water is to provide for treatment, of course, as we've already talked about. Source water protection efforts provide for prevention of problems in the first place, as well as plan review of drinking water treatment systems and supply systems. And so the goal here, again, is to prevent problems before they occur. Public water supply systems can receive technical and financial assistance through the Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund and through requests to our Minnesota Department of Health staff. One of the reasons that many of the reasons for needing a multi-barrier approach is problems can develop in a number of different ways. In Flint, Michigan, for example, they change water supplies and that ultimately, because they hadn't recognized some of the problems that might develop by switching from one supply for their drinking water to another, was that that could lead to corrosion of the pipes and ultimately led to high lead levels in the drinking water supplied to their customers. Illustration of another kind of problem that can develop is in Lake Erie and a number of other surface waters that supply or are the source for drinking water for communities. In Lake Erie, there was a substantial blue-green algae bloom in 2014 and subsequently as well, and the drinking water plants there weren't really set up to deal with the cyanotoxins that are produced by blue-green algae. And so they had to scramble to figure out how to not only identify whether these contaminants were in the source water supplied to the drinking water treatment plant, but then to treat for those. In 2014, there also happened to be a spill in West Virginia that citizens identified as a problem when the water tasted funny to them and they started developing rashes and so on. And so sometimes we find chemicals in unexpected ways in our drinking water, and then again the systems have to scramble in order to treat that and reduce the contaminant levels. PFAS has been found here in the East Metro, but EPA, through their contaminant candidate list process, decided that they would look nationally to see whether there was a wide occurrence. And we had thought, I think, up until the probably about 10 years ago, that PFAS contamination of groundwater systems was relatively limited across the U.S., but once we started surveying for that across the country, it was found to be in wide distribution in many places in the country. And so, again, surveillance is critical in order to be able to identify potential problems that then must be addressed by the public water supply systems. So I'll get close to wrapping up here. There has been a number of treatment technologies developed over the years to help address some of these problems, and those are coming into play in these areas that have complicated contaminant issues to address. For example, again, granular activated carbon filtration is being used to address PFAS here in the Twin Cities, but elsewhere things like reverse osmosis have had been used to address some of these issues. Because I'm coming to the end of my time here, and I've already talked a fair amount about the regulatory process, I think you've probably heard about that. What I want to end with here is just a little bit of conversation about the fact that this just seems to be a problem. We need to be vigilant in our addressing drinking water issues here forever into the future. As I was preparing this talk last week, and I took a break just from looking at these slides to read the newspaper, I noted that our Minnesota Department of Health and Public and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Minnesota Department of Agriculture all received a letter from the EPA last week demanding that additional action be taken to address nitrate issues in southeastern Minnesota. And so as hard as we work here to try and address these issues, this three-barrier approach is just critical in order to be able to help not only survey for problems, but try to address them into the future. And what I'll end with here is just some reflections based on the years I had here and watching the issues as they have developed over the past few years. Again, industry continues to develop new compounds that may pose public health problems if released into the environment, and that is going to continue to be a conundrum. Despite the fact that we have a Clean Water Act and a Safe Drinking Water Act, the contaminants that are addressed in these two are not really very well coordinated, and it would be good to have some additional coordination on that in the future so that wastewater and drinking water treatment rules are better in sync. We find that our laboratory methods are getting better as time goes on, and that means, though, that we now find things in the water that we couldn't see before. That again, poses a challenge. Infrastructure investment will continue to be critical. Many places have not had the resources to update their systems, and that then can lead to contamination problems. Climate change could affect our supplies and demand in the future. And finally, it's just critical, and I think for this audience especially, this aspect of source water protection is really must be a focus for the future. So thank you to our various partners. That includes Minnesota Groundwater Association, but all of the others who are involved one way or another in helping us to provide safe drinking water and protect our sources. And it's a long list. And finally, thank you. We have a little bit of time for questions now. Just want to note that Minnesota Department of Health Drinking Water Program provides an annual report of the quality of drinking water here in Minnesota, and you can find that online, and it's a good thing to see an overview of how we're doing in this state. So thank you.
Definitely have time for a few questions, so please raise your hands and we'll get the microphones over to you. So I have a question for you, Randy. In your 10 years at the Department of Health, when you were heading up the drinking water program and you were also very active on the national stage, is there anything about Minnesota's program or how Minnesota protects drinking water and all the natural resources associated with it that you thought was a little different from how maybe things were happening nationally? Any thoughts and observations from your time?
Well, thanks, Sandeep. I think there were a couple of things that strike me that were that Minnesota had more resources for than most states. First of all, the program that we have with our other section that allows for assessment of public health risks associated with drinking water contaminants, in particular our toxicology staff and the laboratory staff at the Minnesota Department of Health are both national leaders and looked to and respected as resources, not only for Minnesota but elsewhere. And so I was very grateful for that expertise. The other thing that we have had substantially more resources for, in my opinion, never enough, but in terms of source water protection, the program that has developed and the resources that have been made available. But going along with that, the partnerships that has developed among both state and federal agencies, as well as with the public water supplies, is fairly rare and even a bit unusual, I think, across states. And so what was really great for me, for example, was to see this willingness among agencies to work together on these issues around not only drinking water as supplied to customers, but source water protection issues. And so that was great to see.
Well, again, thank you, Randy, for getting us started today, setting the stage for the rest of the day. Many of the things that Randy talked about as the Safe Drinking Water Act has evolved over the last 50 years, you'll see those themes being picked up by some of the other speakers, because those are the offshoots that have come off the Safe Drinking Water Act that really shaped the landscape today.